Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 17th of September, these are our main stories. President Erdogan of Turkey says he wants to send 3 million Syrian refugees back to Syria to an expanded buffer zone in the north. The head of NATO says he's extremely concerned that tensions in the Gulf will escalate following Saturday's attacks on Saudi oil plants. And Luxembourg's prime minister has angrily denounced the Brexit strategy of his British counterpart, Boris Johnson. Also in this podcast, scientists in the United States say they found a way to stop the common cold. President Erdogan of Turkey has said that he wants to send up to 3 million refugees back to Syria to an expanded buffer zone in the north. He said the beginnings of such a safe zone were already being established in cooperation with the United States.
We think that in this area we can accommodate at least 2 million Syrian brothers and sisters who've been sheltering in our country. In fact, if we can extend this zone to Deir Ezzor and Raqqa, the number of Syrians who could return to their country could exceed 3 million.
The Turkish president made the comments in Ankara following talks with his Russian and Iranian counterparts. Russia and Iran strongly support the Syrian government, which is determined to retain control of the whole of the country. Turkey, on the other hand, supports some of the rebels holding out in the province of Idlib, the only region still outside the control of the Syrian government. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston explained what exactly the Turkish president was proposing.
In the course of the long Syrian civil war, Turkey has taken in, as you said, more than 3 million Syrian refugees. And the sad fact is these people have become an increasing burden. The Turkish economy is not what it was, and there are growing tensions between the Turks and the refugees. And Turkey worries that there may be a new influx of refugees as a result of the fighting in Idlib province. But Mr. Erdogan has a plan. He wants to send 3 million Syrian refugees back home, send them to what he calls a safe zone just across the border in northeastern Syria. Now, this is territory that's under the control of American-backed Kurdish fighters. Turkey regards these Kurds as a major threat, terrorists in its eyes linked to Kurdish guerrillas who fight in Turkey itself. Mr. Erdogan has long wanted to push them back from the frontier, and this has already begun to happen. With American help, a thin buffer zone is being established now. But it's clear that Mr. Erdogan wants to massively expand this area, push it way back and create room to send huge number of refugees into this zone. It's quite an ambition. We're yet to hear from the Kurds, but I would imagine they would bitterly, bitterly oppose the idea.
So that's what President Erdogan is suggesting. What about the views of Russia and Iran?
Well, President Putin and President Rouhani both talked of agreeing with Turkey on the need to return refugees to Syria, but they had more immediate concerns of their own. And Mr. Rouhani of Iran excoriated the US for its continuing presence in the US. And both the Russians and the Syrians are keen to cement the military victories of their Syrian government allies. They want to see progress on the political front. They want to see some sort of coming together of the government and the opposition. But that is very, very hard to see happening swiftly, given the extraordinarily deep divisions that go on in Syria.
That was Alan Johnston. President Trump has downplayed the impact of a spike in oil prices in the wake of drone attacks on Saudi Arabian oil facilities. He said prices hadn't risen much and that the United States and other countries could offset the increase by releasing more supply. And speaking to reporters in the Oval Office, Mr. Trump was asked about the attacks.
Have you seen evidence, proof that Iran was behind the attack?
Well, it's looking that way. We'll have some pretty good
We're having some very strong studies done, but it's certainly looking that way at this moment, and we'll let you know. As soon as we find out definitively, we'll let you know, but it does look that way.
Do you want war with Iran?
Do I want war? I don't want war with anybody. I'm somebody that would like not to have war. We have the strongest military in the world. We've spent more than $1.5 trillion in the last short period of time on our military. Nobody's even come close. We have the best equipment in the world. We have the best missiles. But no, I don't want war with anybody, but we're prepared more than anybody.
Earlier, the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, said he's extremely concerned that tensions in the Gulf will escalate following the attacks. Tehran has strongly denied any involvement in the incident, which took out 5% of global oil production. Here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
More than 2 days after the devastating attacks on Saudi Arabia's vital oil infrastructure, there are still unanswered questions about exactly who launched them and from where. Yemen's Houthi rebels, who overthrew the UN-recognized government over 4 years ago, say they sent 10 powerful new drones and have warned of more attacks to come. But a spokesman for the Saudi-led coalition fighting the Houthis, Colonel Turki al-Malki, said initial findings painted a different picture. The evidence, he said, showed the weapons to be Iranian. The attacks were not launched from Yemen, and the Houthis, he added, were merely proxies of Iran's Revolutionary Guards. Iran has vigorously denied any involvement in the attacks, which have badly damaged the very heart of Saudi Arabia's petrochemical industry. The facilities at Abqaiq and Khurais, where fires raged so badly they showed up on satellite images, have extensive defences against attacks by land, but clearly they are vulnerable from the air. The questions now for a nervous oil market are, how long will it take the Saudis to repair the damage, and what guarantees are there that Saudi Arabia's enemies can't carry out a similar attack in a few weeks' time? For the first time since the Yemen conflict began, its effects are now hitting the global economy, while tensions in the Gulf are ratcheted up yet further.
That was Frank Gardner. Well, Dr. Syed Mohammed Mirandi is the head of American Studies at the University of Tehran. Tim Franks asked him, what does he make of the view that only Iran has the capabilities and the motive to at least enable such an attack?
Well, since it was a large attack, no one in Iran believes that it could have been from Iran because the U.S. has a huge military presence in the Persian Gulf. And if they weren't able to such a large attack, then they're either utterly competent or there was no such attack from Iran. The same is true about an attack from Iraq. The U.S. has a huge presence there and an intelligence presence. So it's obviously from Yemen, and this is not new. The Yemenis have been evolving in their defense against Saudi aggression, and they've been carrying out larger and larger drone strikes and with greater precision over time, and they've attacked numerous key installations of the Saudis. So this is to be expected, and I think in future they will probably get even better.
Well, it's interesting that you think that it is from Yemen, because clearly those who would be responsible then are the Houthi rebels, and the Houthi rebels have certainly been supported in the past by Iran. And in order for them to have the sort of capability to get a drone several hundred kilometres to this Saudi oil facility would involve a level of expertise that is beyond them. And the only people who have that expertise who would want to support them are the Iranians.
Well, you know, there's a misrepresentation of what's going on in Yemen. It's not the Houthis. It's the Yemeni government, the people who are in the capital, Sana'a. And they are a state. Whether the United States likes that or not, or the Saudis like that or not, that's irrelevant. They have engineers, they have universities. And I'm sure the Iranians have given them help over the last 4.5 years. But I think the help that the Iranians have given is infinitely less than what the Americans and the British and the French have done for the Saudis.
Well, that's not... We can certainly argue that, but that's not the issue here. The issue here is about the attack on this Saudi oil facility and where the expertise, if not actually the hardware, came from. And we've already had in terms from UN experts on Iran, reports to the Security Council saying that directly and indirectly, those who are fighting against the Saudi-led coalition have had material support from Iran.
Well, they are misrepresented as UN experts, but that's another story. The Iranians have helped the Houthis defend themselves. They've helped, they've aided the Yemeni people defend themselves, probably to a degree. But it's, as I said, the country is under siege. There's a starvation siege that's been going on for years. How could the Iranians bring in so much material into the country when the Americans and the Saudis have surrounded it?
That was Dr. Syed Mohammed Marandi, the head of American Studies at the University of Tehran. The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, had a difficult day in Luxembourg on Monday. He was there to try to persuade European leaders that he's serious about securing a Brexit deal. He skipped out of a joint news conference with his Luxembourg counterpart, Xavier Bettel, to avoid being drowned out by hecklers. Standing next to an empty podium, Mr. Bettel angrily declared that he would not accept any blame for what he called Britain's homemade problems. The European Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker, said it was up to the UK to produce legally workable solutions. Mr. Johnson conceded afterwards that it was a very difficult moment, but said European leaders knew that Britain was working very hard to get a deal. In a BBC interview, the Prime Minister said he was cautiously optimistic about the negotiations with the EU.
I think that they've had a bellyful of all this stuff. You know, they want to develop a new relationship with the UK. They're fed up with these endless negotiations, endless delays. They've now delayed twice before. To achieve what is completely unclear.
Our correspondent Adam Fleming reports on Monday's events in Luxembourg.
There were fewer than 100 anti-Brexit protesters outside the office of Luxembourg's Prime Minister, Xavier Bettel. But the chants, the music and the megaphones made it sound like many, many more. And Boris Johnson was supposed to be doing an outdoor press conference just metres away from them. Behind the scenes, the Luxembourgish and British delegations tried to avoid a diplomatic incident, move inside to a room that wouldn't fit all the journalists, silence the host to save the blushes of the guest, hope the demonstrators would take a break. The end result was an impassioned one-man show by Mr. Bettel. He walked out alone, no Boris Johnson to be seen, and stood, again, alone, in front of EU, Luxembourg and Union flags. Beside him, an empty podium.
Our people need to know what is going to happen to them in 6 weeks' time. They need clarity, they need certainty and they need stability. You can't hold their future hostage for party political gains.
He called on the British to table proposals to break the Brexit deadlock.
For me, I just have one withdrawal agreement on the table, and it's the one from last year. There are no changes. There are no concrete proposals for the moment on the table. And I won't give an agreement to ideas. We need written proposals, and the time is ticking. So stop speaking, but act if you want that we are able to discuss about different proposals. But we won't accept any agreement who goes against the single market or who will be against the Good Friday Agreement.
Instead of being outside at the news conference, Boris Johnson was at the residence of the British ambassador, where he recorded a short interview instead.
I don't think it would have been fair to the Prime Minister of Luxembourg to... I think there was clearly going to be a lot of noise, and I think our points might have been drowned out, but I'm happy to talk to you now.
The trip had begun with the Prime Minister sharing a friendly two-hour lunch of chicken and fish with the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. No concrete proposals were put on the table, but the two sides agreed their negotiating teams should meet on a daily basis. Although this trip is likely to be remembered for a messy media opportunity rather than any momentum injected into the talks.
So what next for Boris Johnson? A question for our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
He's in a spot, and I think it's really, for a second Monday in a row, an EU leader has basically accused him of having lied during the referendum campaign and of failing to level with the British people about the realities of Brexit. I mean, it's pretty awkward stuff, Jackie. Now, Downing Street is insisting, look, we do have some proposals, but I think this intervention from Luxembourg is going to sort of feed those who think, goodness gracious, it looks like the Johnson team are making it up as they go along and they're not serious about a deal. One other brief word about things domestically. Of course, those on the Remain side will think, you know, a second sort of humiliation in Luxembourg confirmed the craziness of Brexit, whereas no doubt leavers in this polarised country will be saying, oh, well, it just shows you why we should be getting away from the EU.
Now, of course, here in London, Parliament is not sitting at the moment. It is
prorogued, and we are expecting 3 days of Supreme Court hearings on whether that's lawful.
Yes, and potentially another three extremely awkward days for Boris Johnson, because the allegation will be made that he was not being truthful when he gave his reasons for suspending Parliament, and that that involves having misled the Queen. And let's say Mr. Johnson and the UK government are not successful in overturning the ruling that he had misled Parliament and the Queen and the country. If he's not successful, then Parliament will have to be recalled, and that would be immensely awkward for him.
That was Rob Watson. Before him, we heard from Adam Fleming. And if you are interested in keeping up with all things Brexit, do look out for the Brexit Cast podcast in all the usual poddy places. Scientists think they have found a way to stop the common cold and other viruses closely related to polio. Instead of trying to attack the viruses directly, the researchers targeted an essential protein inside our cells, which the viruses need to replicate. The approach gave complete protection in experiments on mice and human lung cells. Now the researchers want to test the idea in patients. Here's our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
The common cold gets us all. Adults can expect a couple of bouts of streaming noses every year. In the UK, minor coughs and colds are the main reason we take days off work, around 34 million of them every year. Most colds are caused by rhinoviruses. However, there are around 160 different types, and the viruses can quickly mutate. Developing a drug to stop such a diverse and rapidly changing array has proved impossible. So a team at the University of California, San Francisco and Stanford University tried something different. They targeted the host, in this case, us, humans. Viruses are not truly alive. They need to hijack parts of a host organism in order to replicate. The US team found a protein that cold viruses and more dangerous polio-like viruses were dependent upon. Disabling the protein in mice and human lung cells using gene editing led to complete protection. Professor Jonathan Ball from the University of Nottingham described the study as neat.
To have something that works across the full spectrum of different viruses is really exciting. Viruses are the archetypal shapeshifters, and they find it very easy to mutate and escape the actions of antiviral drugs. By targeting the host, the authors hope to limit the virus's ability to escape.
The US team now want to develop a drug that could be sprayed up the nose to protect us from the common cold. The researchers say this could happen relatively quickly. Until then, a duvet day with a mug of something warm is about all you can do.
No, really, I'll be fine. That was James Gallagher. Still to come in this podcast.
It does look like a creature, this thing, which is, looks like several metres long. It's black, and it looks like it's got a tail that's waving from side to side.
The mysterious creature filmed in the Yangtze River in China. Research by the BBC suggests civilian deaths in Afghanistan may be far higher than previously thought. A BBC team documented every instance of conflict-related violence in the country over the course of August and found the number of deaths to be far higher than that in Syria and Yemen combined over the same period. From Kabul, Sikandar Kamani reports.
Over the course of August, more than 2,300 people lost their lives in Afghanistan as a result of the conflict, according to the BBC's findings. Of them, 473 were civilians. In line with findings by the UN from earlier this year, the BBC's research found that pro-government forces were behind more civilian deaths than the Taliban. Afghan officials say the insurgents are ultimately to blame for the bloodshed and accuse them of hiding amongst ordinary people.
Sikandar Kamani in Afghanistan. For the past 6.5 years, Edward Snowden has lived in Moscow. But now, the former contractor for the US National Security Agency says he'd like to return home to the US. The condition, and he says this is unlikely to be fulfilled, is that he receives a fair trial. Mr. Snowden is wanted by the US authorities to answer charges under the Espionage Act for leaking a huge trove of details about internet and phone surveillance by the US intelligence agencies. Edward Snowden has been speaking to Anthony Mason, Tony DeCopel and Gail King from CBS News, who asked him first, was it worth it?
We see chances, opportunities in life where we can make a decision to try to change something. But nothing changes just if we believe in something. We have to actually be willing to risk something. We have to actually be willing to stand for something.
But you took an oath to the Constitution, Edward. You took an oath not to betray the country. You know, the CIA has what you call an orientation indoctrination program where they have a parade of horribles, and now you're on the list, a parade of horribles. Your picture's there.
Probably, yes. But that's actually an important point, is I was required to swear an oath when I entered onto duty in the CIA. It's a very solemn thing. You're in a darkened room in front of a flag. Everyone else is there. But it's important to notice that we did not say an oath of secrecy. That does not exist. There's a secrecy agreement, but there's also an oath of service. And the oath of service is to support and defend not an agency, not even a president. It's to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, and this is a direct quote, foreign and domestic.
You're living in Russia and have for some time now, as you pointed out, it's not where you want to be, it's where you were forced to be. Have the Russians ever asked for any information from you?
The United States government, for some reason, we don't know whether it was intentionally to create kind of a evergreen political attack against me, guilt by association of being able to point to the Russian government, they canceled my passport. And that went, when I landed, I could no longer travel. So I get pulled out of passport control and brought into a room. And yes, directly, the Russian intelligence service is like, do you want to cooperate? Do you have any information? Life's going to be very hard if you have no one on your side. Even the fact that Russia was probably the hardest place in the world for the CIA to operate. I didn't go, all right, this is great, you know, let me out of the airport. I was stuck in that airport for 40 days.
Do you have concerns, Edward, that Russia is monitoring your actions today? Do you think that they're gathering intelligence on you? Because the optics, as we sit here in America, looking at you in Russia, yeah. You know, the optics are not good.
No, you're absolutely right. Again, and I'm on the same side on this issue.
Then why not come home?
Mr. You know, Snowden. one of the big topics in Europe right now is should Germany and France invite me in to get asylum? Of course, it's problematic, and of course, I would like to return to the United States. That is the ultimate goal. But if I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison, the one bottom line demand that we all have to agree to is that at least I get a fair trial. And that is the one thing the government has refused to guarantee because they won't provide access to what's called a public interest defense.
But Mr. Snowden, in all due respect,
go ahead.
Mr. Snowden, in all due respect, criminals and alleged criminals don't customarily get to decide the terms of their trial. They broke the law and they face the consequences. What makes you different?
Well, I'm not different. Again, I'm not asking for a parade. I'm not asking for a pardon. I'm not asking for a pass. What I'm asking for is a fair trial.
Edward Snowden, and he was speaking to CBS News. A man who's been described as the Da Vinci of the design world, Luigi Collani, has died at the age of 91. His work was prolific and varied. His futuristic designs, which included cars, furniture, cameras and clothes, were famous for their curved shapes and were often made of highly polished plastic in strong colours. Born in Germany, the designer once reflected that he had been a successful swine. Our correspondent in Berlin, Damian McGuinness, looks back on the life of a maverick and innovator.
"My world is round," Luigi Collani once said. And so were the products he designed. Egg-shaped cars, a curved coffin, a circular kitchen with a revolving round chair in the middle. Even his grand piano had barely a straight line. Whether he was designing trucks or trains, Luigi Collani's mission was to change the world by banishing conventional corners and staid straight edges. Curves are natural, beautiful, and even erotic, he argued. He was born in 1928 in Berlin as Lutz Collani, studied sculpture and aerodynamics, and after a stint designing Italian sports cars in the 1950s, changed his name to the much racier Luigi. He had particular success in Japan and China, and didn't always win friends in his native Germany. He condemned German car design as too square in every way, and said other designers were too conventional.
"I, most of the time, am getting upset about the design that's around us. And this is triggering the action. And then we start, and it's not very difficult to be better than the poor designers of today. They are afraid.
His name became a brand. The rounded edges of his 1986 Canon can be seen in many modern digital cameras today. And those curves, his trademark, still influence many other modern products.
That report by Damian McGuinness in Germany on the life of Luigi Colani. Swimming the English Channel once is hard enough, but an American woman is attempting to do it a record four times non-stop. That's 135 kilometres in total, and she's on the final straight of her extraordinary challenge. Sarah Thomas, who's 37 and has recently had treatment for breast cancer, is, as we record this podcast, currently swimming towards the English coast. Kevin Murphy is the official timekeeper and is on board a boat tracking the swim. He says the crossings are creating history.
What we're seeing here is an absolute triumph over adversity, the human spirit triumphing over adversity. I've never seen anything like this. It's not just the endurance of this woman in the water here, it's the fact that she's just keeping going at the same speed. Well, for me, I've done it, I've been there, I haven't managed as much as she is managing. It's absolutely astonishing.
And Sarah Thomas is expected to arrive in Kent on the English coast for the final time early on Tuesday morning. Good luck to her. Now, most of us have heard of Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. Now, another mysterious thing has been spotted and it sparked an online debate in China. Our China media analyst Kerry Allen has seen footage of the thing swimming through the Yangtze River.
It does look like a creature. There's this footage which shows people standing by quite close to the Three Gorges Dam and watching this thing, which is long and it looks like several metres long. It's black and it looks like it's got a tail that's waving from side to side. So it does look like a big snake or a big eel. But there's other footage as well that's been circulating online, which also doesn't look as animated. It literally looks like it could be a bit of tarpaulin or something like that.
The Yangtze is a very big river, and although it's quite heavily polluted, there are creatures that live in it. What's different about this one?
There are absolutely tons of creatures that live in it, and there are also a number of creatures that are literally, you can only find them in the Yangtze River as well. I mean, the biggest known creature is the Great Chinese Salamander, or the Giant Chinese Salamander, which can get to 1.8 metres long, so it's a very long creature, and whatever this is, if it is a real life creature, looks a lot longer. So it started conspiracy theories online on the popular Sina Weibo platform over whether the pollution might have been a factor in something that a snake or a salamander might have been mutated, for example. But there are also some people who do think it's a bit of fun, and they say that they don't think it's a real creature and it might actually just be a bit of cloth or even the local government trying to encourage tourism to the area, because the Three Gorges Dam was a notoriously expensive project and it cost millions and millions of dollars. So more tourism in the area might mean more money.
Just like the Loch Ness Monster. The internet does love a good scary monster theory, doesn't it? So are people generally happy that this is actually a living thing?
Yeah, there have been other cases in China as well where there have been suggestions that there's a mythical creature. There's a well-known one in Xinjiang in the northwest, which there was footage that was filmed, I mean, going back to 1987, of something several metres long. And it was believed to be, well, specialists think that it's a type of salmon that's quite big. This is one of a couple of theories. There was one not too long ago in Yunnan province in southwestern China, where, again, something was seen. A head appeared to come out of the water of some kind of creature, but the local government said it could have been a crocodile or an alligator or just a bit of rubbish.
Dragons are a Chinese thing.
Yeah, a dragon also. That's been one of the things that people have been saying. Be nice if it was.
It's probably not a dragon. That was Kerry Allen. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or share your theories on the Yangtze Monster, yes, you, Bob Blaskowitz, professor in conspiracy theories and paranormal claims in New Jersey, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And after yesterday's corgi story, thank you to Miguel for video of Nino and Gillian for tweeting a very regal photo
photo of her Borgie. That's a Border Collie Corgi cross. Do keep them coming. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.